the House Committee on Rules and Public Affairs, today, March 25, 2003, and I'm going to just open up a simultaneous public hearing on House Bill 3327 and 2874. Doing that to just kind of keep things in order here as we look at that issue together, the issues together on that particular subject, although I know Secretary of State Bradbury is here to discuss only 3327. In fact, if you can, sir, why don't you come on forward?
Thank you, sir.
Get that taken care of.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we should have a discussion with the people who provided the new furniture for these hearing rooms, because these chairs are a lot heavier than the old chairs, just so you know. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I am Bill Bradbury, Oregon Secretary of State, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to testify today. I'm just here to express a concern about House Bill 3327. The bill, as is currently written, transfers all the lobbyist registration, reporting, and enforcement functions from the Government Standards and Practices Commission to the Secretary of State. Now, I'm not here to oppose the bill in its current form. I just want to make very clear to the committee that if these duties were transferred to my agency, we will also require the resources to fulfill the duties of the Government Standards and Practices Commission. We can't just do it by having the duties transferred to us. I take the Secretary of State's statutory requirements very seriously, and in a time where all state government is asked to do more with less, my agency, and particularly the Elections Division, is struggling to keep up with our current statutory obligations. Adding the responsibilities of the Government Standards and Practices Commission to my agency without adding the funding or employees would undoubtedly result in statutory requirements not being met. We wouldn't be able to do all the jobs we're required by law to do if we just added Government Standards and Practices responsibilities to the Elections Division. So as this bill moves forward in the legislative process, I will return during the work session with the fiscal impact on the Secretary of State's agency. We obviously don't produce those until the time that this committee makes a decision to move to work session. And until that time, I would just urge the committee to consider the current resource limitations of the Secretary of State's office of the Elections Division and understand the ramifications of delegating more responsibility to us without funding or authorization for additional employees. And with that, thank you very much, and I'd be more than happy to answer questions if you have any.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair, I noticed there's a subsequent referral to Ways and Means, so I guess what's not clear is, Mr. Bradbury, are you willing to take it if it is funded by Ways and Means?
I'm not here asking that you give it to me, but I think our concern is basically one of a fiscal. It is a fiscal concern that we have. I mean, I'm not here to oppose the transfer. I'm not here to support the transfer. I'm just here to say that there's a fiscal reality related to it that we can't absorb.
Thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay. Maybe if we could, I'd like to go ahead and just recess that public hearing and actually open up the work session on House Bill 2763. And the reason for doing that is that we can get that out of the way and then return back to these other four bills in its entirety and kind of be able to focus a little bit more on the bigger picture, I think, of those issues. So, let's see. As a note, House Bill 2763, we've been told by fiscal, it does have a minimal fiscal impact. What's the force? Is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I move that we move this bill, House Bill 2763, with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Representative Flores says move House Bill 2763 with a due pass recommendation to the floor. Any further discussion? Representative Moss Anderson.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. I came to this legislative session in wanting to look at government trying to get rid of costs so that we could be cutting programs. And this bill was an attempt on the Secretary of State to make the voters' pamphlet pay for itself. And I think that's a really good idea. And taxpayers, when you compare this with paying schools or for medicines, I would say let's make the voters' pamphlet and the county pamphlets pay for itself. So there was an attempt, at my understanding, to have the Secretary of State was attempting to do this. Unfortunately, it wasn't done appropriately because he didn't bring in all of the people who were going to be involved, particularly the city, the special districts. But I will be voting no just because I feel that the process through rules is the appropriate way to do this, and I would like the special districts to be talking with the Secretary of State regarding this issue. And another point I wanted to make also is that when I take a look, I was a school board member, and I only had to pay $25 to run for the school board, and now the cost is $300. And I had a school board member come to me and say, who's running this time, saying, $300, Lori, is a lot of money to pay, but I really like the voter's pamphlet. You know, it's great media, but I'm a volunteer, and I don't have don't raise campaign funds. So with further talk, she did tell me she doesn't have an opponent, but she still wanted to be in the voter's pamphlet. So I think there are a number of issues that need to be dealt with here, but I just feel that we have to start looking at taxpayers, the amount of money that the taxpayers are spending. And voter's pamphlet is one way that we can look at cutting costs. Thank you.
Okay. Further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
We're coming back on.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we can look at this bill from two distinct viewpoints. One, from the perspective of the government entity that is bearing the costs of printing the voter's pamphlet. I also think we can look at this bill from the perspective, or this issue, from the perspective of democracy, let's say from the viewpoint of candidates, many of whom would be running for offices that do not pay anything, that they're, in effect, it's free gratis. I'm choosing to opt to view this from the perspective of the candidate and not from that of the government entity. So I will be supporting this. I also think it's interesting that Mr. Al Davidson from the Marion County Clerk's Office indicated, if my notes are right, that in the old system prior to the change, Marion County subsidized 96% of that voter's pamphlet. With the new changes, the much higher rate, the subsidy was still 83%. In the earlier version, Marion County collected $900. Under the current approach, Marion County is collecting $3,000. My perspective is that it's more valuable that we encourage people to run for office and that they therefore should not have to pay, particularly on pay a great amount, particularly for volunteer positions. And so again, I think this justifies a yes vote. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm sorry. I apologize for being late, and I presume we have opened the work session on 2763.
Right.
I am very disappointed in this process. To begin with, I feel like to make changes through the administrative rules, which does not really focus on the respected parties that are impacted. In other words, if you don't read the book and go down into the middle of it and know what's happening to you, then you have something coming at you. I don't like that. And so for that reason, I've had a hard time getting my arms around this bill. The other thing I don't like is the fact that I've had the special districts people, the community college people, tell me that they pay for the people that are going to be in the voters' pamphlet. So what is this that says we don't want, are subsidizing it? The county clerks are saying they're subsidized. If so, what's being subsidized? I think $25 is too little. I think that I don't believe that a higher amount, not necessarily the 100, but I don't think a higher amount, even if they double the 25 to 50, is too much to ask of a person that's going to be serving on a board. So I respectfully disagree a little bit with my colleague here. So I have gone back and forth and back and forth. I would like to see this changed. I'd like for it to be moved up from 25, and I'd like for the process, obviously, to be very different. I will support the bill simply because I want to keep it moving. And I would like to hope that as it moves along, that some of these recommendations that are going to go will be adhered to. And I'm going to watch this bill, because I think that the way that this process has been gone about has not been satisfactory to me. And I would not want to find out that I had been treated in some way because I didn't read some rule deep into the book of the administrative rules. And we've got to be kinder and nicer to that. We are far more humane to kick people around by saying, well, you're going to get charged. Well, you didn't know it. That's too bad. I'm really sorry about that. And so I will support the bill simply to keep it active and moving and some changes to come about in it.
Okay. Thank you. Further comments? Okay. Go ahead and call the roll.
Rickman Backer.
Aye.
Rickman Barnhart.
Excused.
Rickman Close.
Aye.
Rickman Flores.
Aye.
Representative Morris
Anderson. No.
Rickman Berger.
Aye.
Chair Doyle.
Aye. And the House Bill 2763 does pass, but do pass recommendation. Do we have a carrier? A carrier? Okay, I guess I'll be carrying it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, so you notice when you look for a carrier how everyone looked away? Didn't want any eye contact?
Right. And I think to respond to Representative Berger, I think that we will be seeing some more work on this bill, hopefully on the Senate side, and then be able to come back and address those issues. Good. As we continue it now in a work session, just actually to open a work session for committee drafting requests. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, I move the House Rules and Public Affairs Committee request that Legislative Council prepare the legislative drafts as presented in the letters to Speaker Minnis, dated March 21, 2003, and March 25, 2003.
Okay. Thank you. Representative Flores has moved that the Rules Committee request Legislative Council prepare legislative drafts as presented in the letters to Speaker Minnis, dated March 21 and March 25, 2003. Any discussion? Just to make one point, colleagues, the first one you see, the March 21 date, was really, I think, kind of a comedy of errors with our legislative council, in that we have a bill here that actually you see it was it requires a three-fifths majority vote if it does ever come to the floor. And let me take that back. There was a Senate bill, Senate Bill 874, that was dropped on the Senate side. The Legislative Council allowed to be dropped, even though it had a three-fifths voting requirement. And the only reason we're doing this is because Legislative Council has a rule that says that a legislative draft can only be used for one bill. So even though this has already been drafted, and it was their error to move it to the Senate side, we have to go through this process and waste our time to conform to their rules on getting another bill printed that makes it a House bill. So that's kind of where this is. Any discussion? Okay. The committee request shall be made.
All right.
And no other work session. Okay. Let's now return back then the public hearing, and this we'll do a simultaneous hearing on House Bill 3328, 2958, and 2874. And let's see, we have.
Representative Krupp is coming.
Okay. While we're waiting for Representative Krupp, John DiLorenzo, you come forward. And I think as we see the broad nature of these bills, I mean, basically what I'm looking for today is to give us that big picture view on, two different paths that we can take here. One is the status of various ethics laws that are currently in effect, and if there's issues with those kind of ethics laws, you know, what kind of work can be done to correct that. And then the other side is the process, the work of the current commission and director, and then, you know, what if there's anything there that needs to be addressed. So, Mr. DiLorenzo.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is John DiLorenzo. I'm a lawyer with the Davis Wright Tremaine firm in Portland. I'm here today on my own behalf. Actually, this is the first time in years that I can recall a time that I have not had a client with a pending matter before the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. And so I feel especially unencumbered at this point, and thought that this would be a good opportunity to avail the committee of some of my views in general about how the process is working and what should be done. I'm not here to testify in favor or in opposition to any of the bills that are listed. I do believe that ultimately there should be an omnibus bill, one bill that comes out of this committee that addresses the multiplicity of issues that are going to be presented to you. I was reflecting on my testimony, and I'm amazed. I have practiced for almost 23 years now. I still think of myself as a kid, but I'm starting to tick off the years. And much of that time, I have represented public officials before the GSPC or its predecessor, the Oregon Ethics Commission. I advocated in 1989 for the first Ethics Commission reform law following the Cub Houck case. And that session, with others, was able to persuade the legislature to adopt a statute of limitations, a standard of proof, and a rule which controlled staff comment concerning various pending cases, also a rule which required the governor to appoint the members of the commission. I also advocated amendments in 1991 which resulted in the attorney fee provision, which presently entitles a prevailing office holder to an award of attorney's fees if the office holder prevails. I have probably had more cases before the commission than I can think of. Most recently, the Romaine matters, in which my client's positions and that of the affected legislators were vindicated only after parties took up their right to avail themselves of the services of a court following the commission's findings. I've also had a series of cases relating to cell phone, auto, and other issues, most notably the Bunn case and cases involving Marion County commissioners. In recent years, the commission, in my view, has had a propensity to closely scrutinize its staff recommendations and has, in fact, on a number of occasions, rejected its staff's recommendations on particular cases and particular issues. I think we probably have today a much more active commission than we have had in years, and I frankly applaud the volunteer leadership of the commission in that regard. I think they've done an excellent job of trying to maintain an open mind with respect to recommendations and have not been nearly as staff-driven as previous commissions. Regardless, though, the structure has still, in my view, cost the state of Oregon and its local governments dearly in terms of financial impact, especially as local governments have spent countless hours of attorney and staff time attempting to comply with the Commission's various advisory opinions. It has provided a drain to the Treasury when pursuing bad cases following awards of attorney's fees to prevailing office holders. And it has imposed, in my view, untold personal costs on the various public servants who have found themselves in the sights of a staff investigation. You know, although it would be easy to pin these problems on personnel, I have come to the conclusion that the problems are really more a matter of structure than anything else. The commissioners, like all of our public servants, spend countless hours of volunteer time involved in a process that, frankly, is not very pleasant. I do not believe the problems that I am about to outline really reside in individuals. They reside in the way our system is structured. Let's take, for example, the cost to local governments. The commission has approved advisory opinions on cell phone usage, which are, in my opinion, an exercise of tripping over dollars to pick up pennies. Essentially, a party who has issued a government cell phone may not employ it for personal use, even if one reimburses their local government for the personal use on the cell phone, even if the employer adopts a policy expressly permitting personal use of a cell phone. The advisory opinions regarding cell phone use have created a circumstance in which it is better for a county commissioner who has no particular set hours to miss an entire day of work and stay at home while contractors are at his or her house than to place a call or two on the county cell phone to just check up on the work and therefore be able to devote an entire day to pursuing the public's interest. The costs of accounting to comply with these various rules are higher than any potential benefit that could ever be derived. I think you will find that in the private sector, most large firms have abandoned the practice of even charging employees for personal use on their cell phones because the costs involved in the accounting far outweigh any of the potential benefits that could be derived. But whatever your view on the propriety of these types of rules, my main complaint isn't with respect to the rules themselves, but rather with respect to the method which is utilized by the Commission to proclaim them. As we know, the law prohibits public officials from utilizing their offices to incur personal gains. But what constitutes incurring personal gain is quite often an open question, given the general statute that prohibits it. Well, when faced with that kind of a circumstance, most agencies will engage in rulemaking to refine what the law means, as long as the rules that they develop fit within their statutory charge. The Government Standards and Practices Commission, however, has never engaged in rulemaking, even though it has the statutory authority to do so. The advantage to engaging in rulemaking, of course, to look in, to refine the general statutory rule is that the public is given an opportunity to participate. The public is given an opportunity to comment. Public officials can comment. Local governments can comment. And a rulemaking process can ensue. But the commission doesn't utilize rulemaking. Instead, it utilizes its advisory opinions to proclaim its view of what the law should be without the advantage of public participation. Now, I have argued countless times that the statute, ORS 184.345, the applicable statute provides that advisory opinions are for the purpose of creating safe harbors for public officials. If a public official has a question of the commission can issue an advisory opinion, and so long as the public official acts in accordance with the advisory opinion, the public official is immune from being pursued by the commission. That is a safe harbor. I believe the Ethics Commission, though, or the Government Standards and Practices Commission, has taken this a step further by issuing general advisory opinions, proclaiming what the law happens to be, as opposed to merely creating safe harbors. The Bunn case provided an excellent example of the problem that is caused when the Commission proclaims what the law should be by way of advisory opinions. ORS 184.345 provided that the Department of Administrative Services provided services to the State Board of Education. The superintendent had interpreted that provision to require adherence to DAS guidelines. DAS guidelines and policies specifically allowed for reimbursement for personal auto and for personal telephone use. There was no statute which prohibited such reimbursement as long as it occurred within agency guidelines. Yet the Ethics Commission's advisory opinion, number 98A1003, was contrary. We argued that the advisory opinions did not create law. They merely created safe harbors. The Commission took the opposing point of view, and it was the Commission's view that notwithstanding any disagreement between DAS or the Commission, it would be the Commission rule that would prevail, and that a public official who did not conduct himself or herself in accordance with that rule would be in jeopardy. Well, members of this committee, you can see right away the problems that are created by proclaiming the law through the use of advisory opinions. There is no opportunity for public participation. An advisory opinion involves a commission discussion, caucusing with the Deputy Attorney General, who is assigned to the commission, and publishing, in essence, a proclamation. The law was not designed to permit the commission to proclaim the law through this process. If the commission wishes to proclaim the law, it should have to engage in rulemaking. I have a number of recommendations for the commission. This was merely an example of some of the frustrations we've experienced. First of all, I believe that to fill gaps, the legislature should require the commission to engage in rulemaking. It is the only process that can involve public comment and a solicitation of a variety of views prior to issuing a rule which then has the force of law. Secondly, on matters such as cell phone use, auto use, frequent flyer use, and similar issues, I believe the legislature should adopt a law which permits local governments the option to establish whichever policy works for them in their particular circumstances, and then to provide that any government employee who complies with the local government policy is following the law. There is no reason why local governments should not have their own rules with respect to minor issues like cell phone use and frequent flyer miles and the like. Some rules will work for some local governments and not for others. They should be able to adopt whatever policies work for them, and their employees should merely be held to following their policies. Also, I would consider a structural change to the commission. I believe that the commission can fill a very helpful and useful role. The commission already does that in the area of education. I think there are many public officials who really do not have an adequate understanding of the current code of conduct, and the commission does a good job in its efforts to educate them. I think most of the cases that come before the commission are not intentional violations. Most of the cases do not involve anyone who knowingly wanted to violate the law. A person who serves on a planning commission is usually a volunteer. It will be a sad day if our volunteers who serve in local government need to have a lawyer by their side to advise them constantly of the various pitfalls that are created by this code of conduct and by the various advisory opinions that further interpret that code. It seems to me that there should be two tracks for the commission to follow complaints. One should be a jeopardy tract, and one should be a non-jeopardy tract. I believe that after the commission reviews a complaint, the commission should make an immediate determination as to whether it feels there was an intentional violation. So far, of course, the commission pursues these claims because it feels there is strict liability for violating the rules. If the commission felt that there wasn't an intentional violation, it could pursue a non-jeopardy tract, which wouldn't require lawyers, which wouldn't have any potential for penalties, and would be primarily educational to assist those local government persons to better understand the law and to assist their employers in better understanding the law. I think the commission could do a great service by utilizing non-jeopardy tracts in order to consider many of the complaints. The commission could also then invoke jeopardy tracts, which could then give rise to the full-blown process that we have presently. I also believe, though, that whatever you do, you should retain the attorney fee provisions in the current law. The commission has lost a number of cases. The commission has been required to pay a significant amount in attorney's fees to public officials who have eventually prevailed. But you know, the attorney fee provision is the only thing in the law that has ever permitted a public official to wage a principled defense. Without the attorney fee provision, a public official faces a circumstance in which he or she either should acquiesce to conduct which he or she does not truly believe that person committed, or face financial ruin in many cases, since quite often these cases, if taken to their full extreme, cost $50, $60, $70, even up to $100,000 to prosecute. Without the potential to receive attorney's fees, there would be few, if any, public officials who would ever be willing to wage a principled defense. There are many other solutions and ideas that I have, and I'm sure others in this room have, and I won't belabor you with those at this point. I do believe, though, that it would probably be worthwhile to have this committee convene a work group of sorts to assist the committee in moving through some of these issues and potentially coming together with an omnibus bill, I think, that can address some of the structural problems that I find with the commission right now. Anyway, those are just a few of my ideas. It was pretty much off the cuff. When it comes time to actually have a bill, I will, of course, provide more formal testimony, and I would be more than happy to work with you as a volunteer in this effort if you wish to pursue this matter. Thank you very much. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Sure. Any questions? It's not. Thank you very much,
Chairman.
Appreciate
your
testimony. Okay. Representative Krupp.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp from House District 17. House Bill 2958 is a bill that I drafted out of personal experience. It is a simple bill in concept. Nothing of this nature is ever simple. But at any rate, the reason that I brought this concept forward was it was really just born out of an experience I had as a 12-year volunteer firefighter with my local volunteer fire department, in which one day my chief and I were talking in a meeting about our awards banquet that was upcoming. And this is a banquet where we bring our families in, mostly our spouses and girlfriends. And, of course, I only have a spouse. Let me make that clear. And there's a reason why I make that statement. And you'll find out in a moment. And we have an appreciation dinner where the spouses get to join in an awards celebration, kind of a recap of the year's events of the fire calls that we've been to and the emergency medical situations and all those kinds of things. And it's usually a lot of fun, and it's usually have a catered-in dinner. Well, the chief was saying to me, he said, you know what's weird? He said, is that the district with taxpayer dollars cannot pay for my wife's meal because it has been ruled an inappropriate use of, in essence, taxpayer resources. However, they could pay for my girlfriend's meal. Now, since I don't have a girlfriend and I do have a wife, it sort of impacted me. But when I was a member of this department before I was married, it wasn't a problem. So what the chief had to do is he had to take money out of the volunteers' funds that we get from donations to pay for the volunteer members' wives' dinners, but the district paid for the girlfriends' dinners. And it seemed to me that there was something kind of inconsistent about this, number one, and it also didn't make sense to me. Because I'll tell you, the people that really suffer in the volunteer firefighting business are your spouses and your family members. When you just sat down to Thanksgiving dinner like we did about 6 years ago, and the tones went off, and we had a tanker truck full of propane on its side in the middle of Interstate 5. And we were out there all day and part of the night. Many of us never even got back for Thanksgiving dinner. The tones go off at 2 o'clock in the morning, wakes your wife up out of a dead sleep, and you rush out of the house and go to the fire station and do what you need to do to help people. That bears a problem in your family, in that your family is sacrificing for you to go out and serve others. And I think it's inappropriate that we as a government would say that we can't say thank you to those people by offering them a meal once a year for a total of $35. And that's why I brought this bill forward. I just think it's inconsistent that a girlfriend can be paid for by taxpayer dollars, but a spouse can't. And I think we ought to fix that. That's why I brought this legislation forward. Just as simple as that.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions? No? Very well. Thank you.
Got off easy. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
And just to continue our firefighter path here, Dave Lampoff.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Dave Lampoff. I'm the president of the Oregon Volunteer Firefighter Association. I'm a volunteer lieutenant with Kaiser Fire District. Representative Krupp on this particular bill pretty much got right to the matter. The Volunteer Task Force report that was House Bill 3111 that was charged in the 2001 legislative session to convene and come up with recommendations for volunteer recruitment and retention. One of the items that was addressed was not only the $35 meal allowance, but then also House Bill 2874. What the task force identified is there is no one silver bullet to recruitment and retention of volunteer firefighters. It's a number of items, one of which is the ability to take your spouse to a meal. I'm glad Representative Krupp addressed spouse because about 10% of the firefighters in the state are currently women. So some women wake up their husbands at 2 in the morning. So with that, it's being able to show some reward or gratitude or thank you for all those nights and meals missed and sporting events missed, times when you've had to leave your own birthday, times when you've had to leave your spouse's birthday. So we find that the $35 amount to have a meal purchased for your spouse is definitely within reason. 2874 would allow it to go a little bit further. It's another complimentary bill that you'll hear more of. This is where the local auto parts store wants to be able to give a discount or give, you know, $50 worth of brake shoes to the volunteer firefighters in the community. These are the people that most of you probably have protecting your homes and your families. 8,500 folks in the state are volunteers. There's only 2,700 that are paid. So the majority of the state is protected by volunteer fire service, which parallels the national averages. I'll walk into fire stations as the president of the association, and they'll ask me, hey, somebody brought a plate of cookies. Is it okay if we have these? Actually, according to the Ethics Commission, it isn't. But there's so many things once you get off the I-5 corridor that are done that are not scrutinized that I won't even bring forward here. But depending on your location, you know, kind of sets up the parameters to that. Every businesses and communities, the Jiffy Lube wants to be able to give out discounts. Whatever the business, they want to be able to somehow pay back to the members of the community who donate countless hours to volunteering and protecting them for fires and emergency medical calls. So as representative for the State Association of Volunteers, we are very much in support of both of these bills. Would hope you would also be in support of them. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer any questions.
Okay. Any questions?
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Christy Monson and Candace Haynes.
Chair Doyle, members of the committee, my name is Christy Munson. I represent the League of Oregon Cities, which is an association of 238 cities in Oregon. We are here on more of a general informational session, much like Mr. DiLorenzo was. We've had groups of city attorneys and city officials concerned about the ethics laws and various revisions to ethics laws for quite some time. To be clear, we are not here today to ask you to dilute or to somehow slacken any ethical standards. The League of Oregon Cities stands for the highest ethical standards in public officials, and we train our public officials. We're just having trouble doing so because the law is not clear right now. It is ambiguous, and our public officials are the ones left out in the cold with ambiguous law. In doing so, we are joining many organizations, and you've heard some of them before you now, for clarity and decisiveness in ethics laws. And very briefly, I'm going to point out that the problem is twofold. And then I'm going to ask City Attorney Candace Haynes, who's the City Attorney of McMinnville, to give you some on-the-ground examples of how our public officials are dealing with these ambiguous laws on a day-to-day basis. I'm sorry we couldn't have an elected official here today. We had some people from the City of Salem scheduled, but they weren't able to come. They are very concerned, as are most public officials, with this issue. To start, generally, the problem is twofold. First, over the years, ethics laws have been revised and revised, and this piecemeal revision of ethics laws has created some ambiguous laws and some conflicting laws within the statute, and we need those fixed. We do have some ideas on how to fix those, and we'll be happy to share them with the committee after the work group or before, whenever the committee would like. But more importantly, I'll tell you what results from the ambiguity. As a policy issue, and one that's entirely appropriate for this committee, is people are afraid to run for office. Our local officials are not compensated for their time. As you know, being an elected official is entirely time-consuming. At the local level, it can be even more so, and people are not paid. They're afraid to make decisions. They're hesitant to act when action is called for. They are cognizant that they need to be ethical, overly cognizant. They just don't know what the rules are. Additionally, the policy process in our city councils is often bogged down because what happens, and as you know, this happens in city councils and state legislatures, when you have a political issue, sometimes you get threats saying, I'm going to bring an ethics suit, and that bogs down the policy process, and it's not good for democracy with a small v. Cities and local government officials are spending money to defend unsubstantiated claims or to appear before the GSPC. And this money could be better spent. As you well know, the taxpayers' money could always be better spent. The second prong of what's the problem is the commission structures and procedures. And we need our city attorneys and our public officials to give us a little more input as to how we'd like to see the structures and procedures changed. But we have had feedback that they would like to see some changes, and we'd be happy to work with the work group on those. In particular, just to give you some general concerns, cities have been confused by some of the advisory opinions that have been issued. There's also a perception that perhaps the appointment process could be more finely tuned. And lastly, the procedure now followed by the GSPC doesn't allow for any tiered sanctions or some kind of preventative effect, so that when people who are well-meaning are about to somehow violate the ethics law, that they could perhaps get a letter of reprimand, or that there could be some mechanism. And I know that's what the commission is trying to do with the advisory letters, but perhaps there are some better ways to do that, and we'd be happy to work with the committee to suggest those. And with that, and more interesting testimony, I'm sure, we'll have City Attorney Candace Haynes, who can tell you just how these have had practical effects on our city.
Thank you.
Chair Doyle and members of the committee, my name is Candace Haynes. I'm the city attorney for the city of McMinnville. And when I was speaking with Ms. Munson about this earlier today, I said, you know what this reminds me of? It's not really a trap for the unwary anymore, which is what everybody used to say about the ethics laws. It's become a trap for the wary. I have very ethical people in my city, and they're constantly calling me and saying, Candace, how do I make this work so that I'm not going to be violating the ethics rules? And I say to them, you know, after 25 years of practice in this area, I can't necessarily tell you. I'm going to call Pat Hearn and ask. And I do it over and over, and I'm sure he'd be willing to tell you how many times I bother him with my questions. And the problem is my advice can't be certain because there isn't really a bright line. There's no way I can be sure that I'm right because the law is so incredibly confusing the way that it's written right now. To me, one of the biggest points of confusion is that we have two points that are in conflict. We've got a but-for test, and we've got a gift test. And the way that you balance the two of them, which one trumps the other one, which one goes first, whatever, can be incredibly confusing. But let me give you some of those examples that we were talking about earlier. The but-for test says, I can't do that. Well, I could do that, but for the fact that I am a public official. Okay? No public official shall use or attempt to use official position that would not otherwise be available but for the public official's holding of the official position or office. So that's that test. Then we've got a gift exception, and that talks about certain things that are and aren't gifts, and you can't take certain gifts, and there are certain exceptions to that. And then over kind of under the but-for test, there's another provision that talks about gifts from someone who has a legislative interest in your government agency, as long as the gift is under $100. And recently there's been a determination, which is sort of a change from what used to, as I understand, what used to be the determination, what used to be in the handbook for public officials. There's been a determination that if someone doesn't have a legislative interest, then no gifts at all can come from that person. So when we're talking about the plate of cookies that was mentioned before, okay, a plate of cookies isn't acceptable unless the person giving you that plate of cookies has a legislative interest in your public agency. So let me give you some examples. We've got the dog leg trip, which many people have heard about, I'm sure. I go, okay, Christy tells me no. Last year I attended a conference in Denver. It was the International Municipal Lawyers Association Conference. After that trip, I came directly home. Some people went to that conference and then went from there to visit family members or took a trip into the Rockies or did a variety of things, kind of dog-legged another trip onto there. If you take the but-for test and read it exactly as it's written, you wouldn't have been in Denver but for the fact that your government agency sent you there. And so you're getting a benefit from the fact that your agency sent you there, and you shouldn't be able to use that benefit to dogleg a trip onto the end of, or the beginning of, if you choose, the trip that you took at the expense of your government agency. Now, yes, and as Christy reminds me, obviously the people who went into the Rockies and the people who went to visit relatives, they paid for that. The government agency got them to Denver, got them from Denver back home, but the people paid for any extra dogleg trips that they took. But
The strict reading of a but-for test would tell you that you wouldn't have been in Denver in the first place, so you couldn't take that dogleg trip. Now, we've also got situations where people can actually take a trip. For example, this isn't how it worked, but let me give you this as an example. Perhaps when I registered, when I signed up, got my reservations to go to Denver, if I had stayed over a Saturday night, my airline ticket would have been cheaper. But I can't save my agency money because that would give me a little bit of a dogleg on that trip, and I would be violating the but-for test. And obviously you can take this to an extreme that's ridiculous, but when you read the actual wording of the statute, that's what it really says. So we have real concerns about that. We also have concerns about the plate of cookies, and in my personal situation, nobody ever brings me cookies. But I do have a really wonderful gentleman friend in McMinnville who absolutely adores me and my assistant. And he goes out in his garden every spring and he cuts his gladiolus and brings them in for us. And strictly speaking, I consider the guy a friend, so I think I'm probably okay taking his flowers, but strictly speaking, you know, it's no gift is okay because this guy doesn't have a legislative interest in the city of McMinnville. So I shouldn't really probably be taking the flowers. And I hope, I sincerely hope that he's a good enough friend that it's just a gift from a friend at this point. But there's a gift problem that we do face, and we face it all the time. We have people who want to bring cookies on a weekly basis to our fire department and our police department, and certainly at Christmas time people want to bring gifts. We get along really well with our citizens in McMinnville, and people want to do this, and we're telling them that we can't accept these kindnesses that they want to give to us. So what I really am hoping to tell you when I explain to you about this gift is that a nice bright line would be really wonderful if someone can someone with a legislative interest can give a member of the government organization a gift. It would be really nice if someone without a legislative interest could give that same gift, so that we'd have a bright line, so that we could actually cut off and really have a sharp way of knowing whether or not this was acceptable. The third thing that I wanted to bring up is that there is a difference between what a local government, any government person, can accept when they're at a conference and when they're sitting in their office. When I go to a conference, I can pick up a pen. I can take home a calculator. I can take home a mug. I can take home a binder for the materials that are handed out. As long as it's under $100, I can take that home. If I'm sitting in my office and someone comes in and hands me that same item, I have to say no, I can't accept that. So there's an opinion out there that says that there is a de minimis exception to getting small things if you're at a conference. But that same exception does not apply when you're sitting in your office. Again, another trap for people who are extremely wary, not unwary. And I'd just, again, love to see a very bright line test where we would know, where we would absolutely know, so that when my fire chief or my police chief or, heaven knows, any given day of the week, it can be anyone, comes into my office and says, this is the offer that's been made. I can get $300 off on this Suzuki motorcycle because I'm a firefighter. Or this guy wants to give me a CD because he's a musician and I just recovered all of his stolen property. If I had a way of always knowing exactly what to say to those people, yes, no, it would certainly make life a lot easier and it would help us all to be more ethical people and follow the laws.
If I may, Chair, can I add a couple more comments?
Sure.
Very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
Christy Munson again with the League. I just wanted to end that this isn't about giving government officials gifts. I think people have honed in on the gift problem because it is a direct conflict in the statute right now, and nobody knows what the rule is. We just want to know what the rule is. My city attorneys have advised me that keeping gifts away from public officials in the general sense is a good idea, but what we're looking for is clarity here, and we're looking for some definite rules for our people. We just look forward to working on any work group and providing that clarity and fairness to the law. Thank you.
Thank you. Great. Genoa Ingram.
Thank you. Excuse me, Mr. Chairman.
All right.
I guess I could, Jenna Ingram with the Oregon Fire District Directors Association. I suppose I could start out by saying this bill is a sight for sore eyes.
So you just didn't get through a commission hearing?
No, Mr. Chairman. I had a couple of surgeries last week for a detached retina, and I apologize that I was not able to keep our appointment to discuss some of these issues. Again, Jenna Ingram, Oregon Fire District Directors Association. My testimony will actually be in two parts today. First, I would like to focus on House Bill 2874, which is a bill that was brought forward in direct response to the situation that Representative Krupp outlined, and then I would also like to do just a brief overview of some of the ethics issues that have been troublesome to us. As you heard, the statutes provide that the $100 limit on gifts is allowable if there is a legislative or administrative interest, and I won't beat that to death. It does not seem right to us that, for example, I could take Representative Berger and her very handsome spouse out to dinner, but if I were to take a volunteer firefighter, I would not be able to take the firefighter's spouse because I do not have the legislative interest. Now, this may not seem like a big deal, but let me tell you that in Oregon, we have what the rest of the nation is experiencing with regard to problems recruiting and retaining volunteer firefighters. It's a big problem for us. Stations are being closed because, as you heard, the bulk of the firefighters in Oregon are volunteers. They are not paid. The Oregon Fire District Directors Association has been advised in writing that it is illegal to purchase the dinner for the spouse at the annual banquet. And again, that may not seem like a very big thing, but when you have a wife of or a husband of 30 years who has to cough up the money for their dinner when the girlfriend or the boyfriend of the firefighter can get the dinner for free, it does cause some hard feelings. It causes people not to go to the banquets, and it frankly causes strife within the districts. Last legislative session, the Oregon Fire District Directors Association, with Representative Krupp's help, brought forward House Bill 3107. It is nearly, as I can tell, identical to House Bill 2958, which is Representative Krupp's bill outlining the $35 limit. We thought that bill was going to just sail through. It was actually placed on the consent calendar after it came out of committee, but never saw the light of day because it caused some concerns, quite frankly, between some members of the lobby who felt that if we were going to carve out that very narrow exception for firefighters or for the $35 fee, that it somehow would cast a shadow on some of the activities between lobbyists and legislators, and they were concerned about that aspect of the bill, so the bill did not move forward. What we have attempted to do with House Bill 2874 is alleviate those fears by simply mirroring the $100 cap that is allowable when there is a legislative or administrative interest, and say that cap also pertains when there is not a legislative or administrative interest. I have attached to the back of my testimony, first of all, a copy of the advisory opinion regarding the banquet scenario. I also attached a letter that came out right after or shortly after the events of 9/11, where JCPenney sent out a letter to every police officer and firefighter, we believe, in the nation, saying, "Dear hometown hero, thank you for all that you do and contribute every day. We've set aside a special day for you. If you, next time, or let me see, I guess the date is April 14th, and this was back a couple of years ago. If you come into the store on that date, we would like to thank you by giving you an additional 20% off of your purchase." That particular practice, as you've heard, is illegal because the firefighter, who is defined as a public official, incidentally under the same statute that you all are defined as public officials, would be using the office for gain. This, I mentioned a second ago, this was a problem nationwide with the issue of attracting and retaining volunteers as far back as 1997, 1998. The Federal Emergency Management Agency, FEMA, put out a book that would help states attract and retain volunteer firefighters. In that book, they list just a number of things that they suggest to do to bring firefighters and their families, to attract them to the districts, to provide them some incentive, if you will, to serve as volunteers. One of the things that they stress most strongly is involving the family, because that appears to be one of the biggest aversions, if you will, to serving, is that it takes time away from the family. The family, in some cases, doesn't agree or doesn't appreciate all of the time that's being spent. The phone calls, as you said, or as was heard earlier, in the middle of the night. So FEMA suggests involving the family in things like picnics, dinners, etc. And again, in Oregon, those types of things are not allowed. Other states do things such as a property tax credit. Some do free cable for volunteers. There are all sorts of things that people do to try to provide incentives for volunteers, and again, those are not legal. I think we've probably belabored that point enough today with the testimony that you heard earlier, but I would like to touch on just a few of the other issues that we'll be hopefully discussing. Before I leave that one, though, I would just urge you, this has been something that we have been trying to fix now for 4 years, and I would just hate to see it go to a work group and become part of a big omnibus bill that gets bogged down, and then this November or December we're going to be right back in the same place that we have been, where the volunteer firefighters are coughing up money for their spouse's dinner. I would just urge that that this piece be allowed to move forward, because we feel that it is an urgent matter that needs to be dealt with, and it's long overdue.
General, let me stop you there. Just on that point, I mean, obviously you represent a particular group of individuals, the firefighters, but you know, if we proceed forward with that issue, I mean, just to the exclusion of everything else, how do you respond to, you know, other public officials that have the same, or that are under the same burden, and basically you're just asking for the clarification for the firefighters?
Mr. Chair, I would call your attention to the requesters of this particular bill. We are not in any way asking that any delay be, or that any of these issues be delayed. We also represent the Special Districts Association, and I want to touch on some of those issues as well. We're not asking that it be held up to the detriment of these other issues. I'm just saying they've tried now for two sessions to get something through, and it's, you know, we're in a crisis situation, not just in Oregon, but nationwide, with respect to retaining volunteer firefighters. And it is, there's a very great sense of urgency. We do have other issues that affect other local officials, and I would like to, Mr. Chairman, just address a few of those things. We have another bill that I assume you'll be hearing before this committee. It's House Bill 3352, which has to do with local elected officials, or not necessarily elected, local officials being able to submit budgets that contain their own salaries. Now, in most cases, the chief of police or the city manager or other public officials has a very real part in putting together a budget and bringing it to the governing body. About 14 months ago, the Government Standards and Practices Commission issued an opinion saying that that was using their office for financial gain. If that budget proposal included their own salary, then they were using their office for public gain, or for, I'm sorry, financial gain. There was an opinion that came out several months later that said, well, okay, in some circumstances, and these are the circumstances where it's okay. And then finally, last October, there was an opinion saying, well, it's all right. Now, we have fire districts that have completely removed their chief from the budgeting process, and it stands that way today, even in light of the October ruling. And the reason is that they feel that, well, it may be okay today, but if there have been three separate opinions saying three separate things in a little over a year, we don't know where we stand, and we are concerned about putting our chief of police or city manager in that position. So that is something that we feel definitely needs to be addressed.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, from Los Angeles.
Thank you. Just a brief explanation. When you have a banquet and the money's used, and I understand only to pay for the volunteer firefighter, that money comes from where?
As Mr. Chair, Representative Monis Anderson, as you heard Mr. Lapoff testify, sometimes it comes from a a pot of contributions that have been contributed for the volunteers. It comes out of a fund for the volunteers. I was speaking this morning with a gentleman who has been involved with the fire districts for many, many years, and what they do at in their district is following the banquet at the very next meeting, they just go around and say, okay, bill so-and-so this much, bill so-and-so that much, and they actually have the volunteer pay for the meal, so it can come from several places. One of the issues that we did not bring forward that if there's a work group, we would most definitely like to participate in, and Mr. Chairman, this is an issue that does go right to the heart of every local elected official, and that has to do with the issue of civil penalties. We are finding that it is increasingly more difficult to find people who will run for office if they know, if they come to understand that if they make a technical error and they do not benefit monetarily or in any other way from this error, but it is a simple technical error, for example, they may go into executive session improperly when they should not have gone into. If these people are, they're currently being fined a penalty that they have to pay whether or not they knew they were doing anything wrong and whether or not they received any kind of monetary gain for that technical error. We did not request a bill because at the time the League of Oregon Cities was trying to negotiate with the Government Standards and Practices Commission to work out some sort of non-legislative remedy, and as we understand, those negotiations have not been successful. But we would submit to you that if someone makes an error, much like I'd like to use the example of a traffic violation, you're not necessarily fined. You may be required to go to traffic school, or you may be required to do several other things. We would like to see a menu approach. Maybe if for the first infraction you receive a letter of reprimand. If something similar happens or a little stronger, then maybe you should go to a class on ethics laws. But just to make someone personally liable for a fine is going to make it very, very difficult to find people to continue to run for these offices, as you heard earlier, for which many of them are not compensated. I would just like to close on one final thought. I met with the joint legislative fire, I'm sorry, the joint legislative fire, joint fire legislative committee this morning, and one of the things that they asked me to convey to you is, we do not intend, we're bringing forth about four or five bills, different issues, and they don't want to give the impression that this is some sort of witch hunt aimed at the staff of Government Standards and Practices. What they clearly understand is that the law itself is not clear. And any time that we have called upon Government Standards and Practices staff, they have been extremely helpful in letting us know, advising us what we should and should not do. We, for example, faxed the JCPenney letter to them, and we were told no, under Oregon law, that that would not be allowed. So it's not that it's the staff. It's, we truly believe that the laws are in very much need of clarification. I'd be happy to answer any questions if there are any. I appreciate the fact that you're hearing these bills, and we look forward to working with you.
Okay. Questions? I have one. It's, I guess, goes to the issues you're talking about on getting these questions. Once they are there, complaints filed against your members for these ethics violations, and
Mr.
I mean, what's
Chairman,
the frequency?
I can think of. Fortunately, we have never had one filed for the banquet. I mean, it's such a small thing. I don't know if they just overlook it or if nobody's reporting it or whatever the situation is, the Government Standards and Practices may be able to shed some light. I can tell you that there was absolutely a case within the last year where it involved a fire station or a fire district. Without saying too much, this particular board went into executive session when the issue being discussed was not appropriate. Now, they did not do that because they were planning to line their pockets or anything of that nature. It was just something that they felt was needed to be treated discreetly. So they went into executive session, and each of those individuals were fined a civil penalty. So, yes, it does happen.
Okay, and in that instance, I mean, did they all have to retain legal counsel, or did the district association handle it?
Mr. Chairman, the association, as I recall, did assist them with legal counsel. The conclusion was a stipulated order whereby they said, okay, we did it, we're guilty, here's the fine. And in situations like that where people are going to be very reluctant to continue to run for office when they make an honest mistake and are held personally liable for those types of fees.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee. Thank you very much.
Okay, Randy Tucker.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I, for the record, Randy Tucker, 1000 Friends of Oregon. We're a land use advocacy organization, and I, even though I'm often in this room, I'm not often before this committee, not at least in this capacity, and so I'm a little bit of a fish out of water here in this hearing. I'm here, I'll be very brief, I'm here at the suggestion of the chair to raise an issue that I raised in a hearing on a bill that we've introduced, or that we've asked to be introduced, that was heard last week, I believe, before the Environment and Land Use Committee in this room. And I've reproduced for you the testimony that I distributed at that time, and then I just jotted the numbers of the bills that you're hearing today on the top right there so that you can file it properly. This legislation is something that we've supported for a few sessions now, and it's actually passed both the House and the Senate, but in different sessions. So that doesn't get it anywhere. and it's passed overwhelmingly each time, I might add. I'm still learning this process, but I think I figured out that doesn't work very well. The bill has to do with the integrity of land use decisions and a situation where a person that's an elected or an appointed official at the local level making a land use decision has a family or a business relationship with a person who is testifying before them on that matter. We're mainly concerned with quasi-judicial decisions in which the decision maker is sitting in the capacity essentially of a judge making what is supposed to be an impartial decision based on the facts and the law of a specific matter at the local level. The bill also, by the way, as drafted now, addresses decisions at LCDC. Chair Doyle is on the Land Use and Environment Committee and suggested that maybe this would be a proper forum for raising these issues, discussing them maybe in a context broader than just land use. And without getting into much detail further than that, I think I just wanted to throw that out there and we'll be glad to participate in whatever discussions are ongoing about other ethics law changes and see if the relating clauses of these bills or others might be appropriate places to address these issues. I do recall, I believe Representative Backlund was on the Judiciary Committee last session and heard what this bill is last session. It moved through that committee at that time and was worked fairly extensively. There's a summary on the back of the fourth page of the testimony I handed out of this session's bill, what we're trying to get at. But beyond that, I think it's probably superfluous to go much farther at this point. I just want to be on the record and request an opportunity to raise these issues in the proper forum, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you. Questions?
Well, I forgot to say one thing. I mentioned to John DiLorenzo on his way out. I still think of him as a kid, too. Makes me feel younger.
Yeah. Okay. Right. Sandy Fletcher. Oh, I'm sorry.
I have a question about conflict of interest.
Is that a question for Mr. Tucker? Or?
Well, that's fine, Randy, if you can kind of address this. For instance, in your written testimony, you refer to organization where there was relatives involved. But I believe it's based on the pecuniary interest. In other words, if you don't benefit financially, now I need probably Chairman Doyle, you can tell me this as a lawyer, but I believe that as long as there is not a financial gain by that individual, even though you and I may feel that, whoa, this really is, the cards are stacked against us here, because of bloodline, I don't think it plays into it. Am I wrong about that?
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I believe that's correct. I don't set myself up, by the way, as any kind of an expert on existing ethics law in the state. My understanding of the conflict of interest statutes is that that's sort of the focus, is when there's a potential for gain by the public official. Our concern is with the integrity of a decision and the public's perception of the integrity of decision-making. Think of it this way. If you went to court and you were up against the brother of the judge, even if the judge had no pecuniary interest in the matter, you wouldn't think of that as being a fair situation. The situations that I'm concerned with, that our bill is concerned with, are quasi-judicial decisions, which should be effectively the equivalent of being in court, where you have a fairly impartial decision-making body. They're not really policy decisions as much as they are judicial decisions. And I should also hasten to add here, I'm not an attorney either. So I'd be glad to be corrected on any statements I'm making here. But we're not talking about political decisions of the sort of, you know, policy decisions of the sort that you make in the legislature. We're talking mainly about quasi-judicial decisions where there is an expectation of impartiality, and that even if there's not a pecuniary interest at stake, it's important that the integrity of those decisions be above reproach. If that answers your question.
Mr. Chairman, follow up. I thoroughly agree with you. I'm just not sure that it's in the law.
That's why we're bringing this bill, Representative
Baker.
Right. It's not in the law.
I think that's the problem, that up until now, up until you've brought this, it really, so many things didn't matter, even though it probably was not impartial or it wasn't really right. But unless there was some pecuniary interest, and even when there was a pecuniary interest, I believe that person can still vote. I believe that once they declare the conflict of interest, that they still have a right to vote,
right,
under the law as it is presently.
And Madam Chair, Representative Berger, that's the concern that we have, and in the testimony that I've distributed, there are a couple of cases that are mentioned. This is testimony that's been just slightly modified from what we turned in last session on this. There are some cases here where it seems clear that there was an appearance of bias or a lack of impartiality, and yet when those decisions were challenged, they were upheld. And so we're trying to address that by making it clear in the law that when you're talking about a quasi-judicial decision in which people before the decision-making body have a family or business relationships with the decision makers, that at least trigger a decision. And actually, the way the bill is written, it gives some discretion to the decision maker to determine whether the relationship creates an appearance of bias or other impropriety. So it's not a hard and fast, if you sold some baseball cards to somebody in the eighth grade, you've got a business relationship and you can't participate in a decision. And I think the hamburger question that was raised earlier, or the dinner question that was raised earlier, would also fall well below the threshold and wouldn't be a business or a family relationship in any event. There's a reasonable person test in the language that we've in the bill that we brought forward, I think that would take away these problems of de minimis business relationships of the sort I just described. That said, I understand there were several technical issues raised with respect to our bill, before the Environment and Land Use Committee. We're certainly willing to address those, and I think there are some continuing concerns that the bill has some problems, and I'd be glad to work on those as well with interested parties who have already, we're already talking.
Other questions? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I
wasn't quite as brief as I thought.
It's one of those things, usually the questions are brief, it's the answers that we have to work on. Members, just for a few moments, I want to just recess this public hearing so that we can have our legislative counsel come in for rebuttal to some of the chair's comments made earlier this afternoon. So we will go ahead and recess that. Mr. Chamoff.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I understand that there was a suggestion made this afternoon that there is the necessity to obtain a draft measure for introduction in this body because there was some mistake made by our office. That suggestion is false. We did not make any mistake. There was a measure requested by the Senate Committee on Rules that, in our opinion, is a measure for raising revenue, requiring introduction in the House of Representatives and a 3/5 vote. We provided that advice to the Senate Committee on Revenue, and despite our advice, the committee introduced the measure in the Senate. When that happened, we immediately informed the leadership offices that the measure could not proceed in the Senate, and that if the body desired to have a measure that could proceed, the measure needed to be redrafted and introduced in the House. There's also been a suggestion that you all are bound by some sort of rules that we formulate. That is not the case. We play by the rules that you require us to play by. Those rules include our putting in the title of a bill the requirement of a 3/5 vote when, in our best opinion, the measure requires a 3/5 vote. So there may be times when our legal opinion differs from yours, but for now, you've told us that it's our responsibility to provide you with our best advice, our expert advice on this issue, so that you can follow it. Thank you.
Okay. Representative Berger.
Now, I want to really understand this. In other words, we've made the rule and you followed the rule and we didn't concur, and so it's your fault? I mean, that's I've been there before.
Representative Berger, that was what I heard.
Okay. Well, I would just say kind of welcome to our fraternity.
Thank you. Thank you for your indulgence.
Thank you. Let's now reopen the simultaneous hearing on 2874,
3328, and 2958, and Sandy Flicker. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Sandy Flicker, and I represent the Oregon Rural Electric Cooperative Association, and I hope to be even way briefer than Mr. Tucker up here. My purpose for being here today is to share with you a letter that's being distributed that was a letter sent to Representative Bob Jensen from Oregon Trail Electric Cooperative, who have had an interpretation from the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission that they find troublesome regarding the ability to compensate one of their board members. And electric cooperatives have elected board members that are the governing board of the electric cooperative. They're members of the co-op. And there is a question about the ability to compensate this particular person because in his real life he is an electrical contractor. And so in order not to get into the issue too deeply, because I am not able to get into the issue too deeply, I really am here today to ask for an opportunity to participate with the work group. Representative Jensen is interested in trying to help the co-op resolve this issue. This statute is the statute that needs to be looked at. The statute is the same statute that has opened up with these other bills. And so I really am here today, again, just to ask for the opportunity to participate in the work group in order to see if we can find a solution to the problem for Oregon Trail Electric Co-op.
Thank you. Thank you. Questions?
No?
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Amy. And let's see. Looks like Chuck Bennett's going to bat clean up. And just Chuck, so you know, we're on, I mean, you signed up to testify on 3328. We have not we are not on public hearing at this point at 3327.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm representing the Capitol Club on this bill, an organization of professional lobbyists here in the Capitol. Mr. Chairman, I became familiar with the ethics law beginning in 1973 as a reporter on the Capitol Journal. I served as a member of my local planning commission in Gates and filed one. I have been an elected member of this assembly and a lobbyist, so I've dealt with the Capitol Club from a whole batch of perspectives, and as well as being a volunteer firefighter for several years in Gates, and I feel like I'm living in a fool's paradise without being completely paranoid after listening to all this. But frankly, Mr. Chairman, just on behalf of the broad number of legislators, lobbyists, and I think people who have dealt with the Ethics Commission as either appointed people, legislators, even as volunteer firefighters, thousands of us have made it through this process without getting into any kind of problem with the Ethics Commission or Government Standards and Practices Commission, as it's known today, and I think I've had successful relationships with them, aside from receiving the forms we get every several months to fill out. So I hope that it's understood that we're dealing always with exceptions with these, and that the broad number of us that deal in these areas tend not to have any dealings with this commission. I'd like to just speak to one portion of this bill specifically that we're concerned about. Is contained on pages 11 and 12, requires reporting of all lobbying expenditures over $50, and deletes the indexing amount for inflation. I understand, Mr. Chairman, that there is interest at times in just creating a flat number, thinking it makes it a lot easier for everyone. The history of this, as you can read even in the legislation, was that in 1979, legislation was passed to begin indexing this amount forward based on the Consumer Price Index, because rather than having a flat rate that began to require reporting of virtually everyone who was receiving a meal, this thing began to grow as the price index increased. Frankly, Mr. Chairman, if you chose to set the amount at $50 without the indexing increasing, I would foresee that within 10 years we'll be reporting everyone's cup of coffee and Big Mac. That's the kind of inflation concerns we have. This is working very well. Once a year, lobbyists, legislators, and clients, if they're interested, can check with the commission and determine what the amount is for this year and adjust their reporting requirements accordingly. It is not a burden on us as lobbyists. We think it works extremely well, and we would hope it stays that way, and ask you to remove that from this bill. Ms. Chairman, if you do decide to form a work group and determine that you would like to have portions of these lobbying requirements or this portion or any other portion of those statutes governing lobbyists included, I'd ask that you take a look at including either myself or some other representative from the Capitol Club to represent the interests of professional lobbyists on this. I think we have a lot of experience we can share on it.
Thank you. Questions? Okay. There are several members of the Government Practices and Standards Commission here, as well as their executive director. They're available for questions if you have any. Any interest in asking them questions at this point?
I have one question for someone from the commission.
Okay, thanks. Thank you. Sure.
Good afternoon. My name is Dave Moss. I am the lucky and honored person to be the chair of the Oregon Government Standards and Practices Commission. And I would be more than happy to answer any question if I can. With me is Patrick Hearn, who is the director of the commission. And if I can't answer it, he probably can.
Thank you very much. I hope this isn't unfair to you to call you up right after you heard testimony and haven't had a chance to think about it.
Not at all.
But I wondered what your reaction was to the jeopardy, no jeopardy that reminded me of the small claims court. It's kind of where you take things that are not too innocuous and put them off over here. And I just wondered what you thought of that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Verger, I'd like to preface my remarks by saying that I have not discussed any of the legislation or ideas with other members of the commission, and so I can't provide you with a commission viewpoint. But I have been on the commission now since September of 2000, and I think we can. There's a general agreement among the commission about what's working and what's not. One of the frustrations that we meet as commissioners is that we are charged and take an oath of office to uphold the Oregon statutes. And the statutes do, in fact, draw a very tight line on a lot of behavior. And we are under those statutes to find out whether or not a violation of those statutes has occurred and then assess a penalty. But not until we are looking at the penalty can we consider whether there was an intent involved. The issue is whether the line was crossed. Then the question is, was there an intent to cross the line, or was it just a mistake? And so the idea of a double track will require statutory change in some way, because right now we can't really say there's a jeopardy track and there's a non-jeopardy track, because we don't have the ability to sort complaints based on that, because it would require sort of an intent determination before we've even looked at whether or not a violation occurred. I don't know if that really answers it, but I'm not saying that we wouldn't be glad to look at it. I think a lot of us would be happy to have something like that. I've been banging around politics for 25 years. I've been an elected official. I've been a staff member to elected officials. I've been a lobbyist. Mr. Bennett doesn't have a whole lot of experience with this commission more than I do. And now I'm on it. And I'll tell you the truth, I'd rather be reporting to it than be on it. Because we're asked to make a determination when clearly there was no intent to violate the law. And that's a very hard thing to do. And we feel maybe we make it up when we don't assign too much of a penalty. But having said that, and if you'll give me a little latitude, I'll say that I'm surprised we weren't accused of the falling birth rate and a few other things, because folks, the law, the code of ethics of the state of Oregon is in statute, and we are enforcing that statute, and that's what we're asked to do. I find it difficult to believe that a code of ethics is preventing people from providing public service. I think it's being used as a scapegoat. But having said that, we'll look at anything, because this is not a well-written law. And there's no one here that was involved in writing it, thank you. But this is not a well-written law. It's a very difficult law to understand. I reread it before every commission meeting, because I cannot keep in my head for 6 weeks the nuances of this law.
I appreciate that, Mr. Mm-hmm. Chairman. I think that's a good thing for us to hear, that the reinforcement that it is a complicated law. And all right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you. I guess that's all we had.
That was very easy.
Yeah.
We would like to leave just for your edification. We could leave some statistics over the last few years: cases filed, cases dismissed, what have you. And one point that did come up is the need for education. We put our director on the road more than once a week all throughout the biennium, making presentations at any group we can find. There was a senator from the Albany area. The joke always was, if there are three cars parked somewhere, she'd stop and make a presentation. We're very close to that with our director.
Thank you very much. Well, committee, I guess we do see that we have some issues here to deal with, and it is my intention to form a work group on this. I'm not sure if there's other members that have an interest to serve on that, but I have asked Representative Flores to chair this work group. I'm also looking to have Christy Monson, Jenna Ingram, and John DiLorenzo. And let me just ask Genoa, is there a need for special districts to have an additional representative on this task force or work group?
Mr. Chairman, Genoa Ingram, Western Advocates does represent the Special Districts Association. However, their executive director for the Special Districts is in the back of the room. If he feels there's an additional member needed, I'm sure he will move up.
Mr. Baker? Okay. Okay,
thank you.
Thank you,
Mr. Chair.
And then I kind of use that group then as kind of the core. Oh, and in addition to that, I think I'll recruit Mr. Moss to be on this work group as well. And then have that as the core group, and then look to having Randy Tucker and Sandy Flicker, and then a representative from the Capital Club to just float in as you need to address those issues that are specific to you, and see if we can get a meeting over the next week or so, just to kind of have the group set out I think the parameters on how far they think we can go through the rest of the session here with some reform, and then we'll have a better idea at that point how long it's going to take to get something like an omnibus bill that's going to tackle a lot of these issues together. So let's then close the public hearings, the simultaneous hearings that we had, and then open up finally reopen the public hearing on House Bill 3327. And Chuck Bennett, you want to come back for that one?
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Chuck Bennett. I'm representing the Capital Club, an organization of professional lobbyists here in the Capitol. Mr. Chairman, this is just to express the Capital Club's opposition to House Bill 3327, and particularly, well, just fundamentally asking you to look very, very closely at whether you would ever want to place the ethics infrastructure in the hands of an elected official. A number of us have talked about this over and over, trying to figure out how this would work. And frankly, in its worst case, and this certainly doesn't involve anyone I've ever known as Secretary of State or the current secretaries or anyone that will be Secretary of State, but it is such a difficult situation to ask an elected official to deal with questions of ethics, dealing particularly with lobbyists, and absolutely separate the relationship between contributions and that supervisory or statutory function. In talking with a couple of long-term lobbyists, they suggested that I recommend to you the Public Utility Commissioner, that I recommend to you virtually any other appointed official if you feel like it needs to leave its home with standards and practices, but please don't put this under an elected official. It would result in, it only creates potential mistrust, public misunderstanding, and certainly under the worst circumstances, the potential for mischief, and that would be really too bad. We are not unhappy with the current situation in terms of the relationship with the lobby.
Okay. Any questions? Okay.
Thank you.
And no one else scheduled to testify on 3327, so we will close that public hearing. And looks like we are done for the day, so we'll adjourn the Rules Committee.